Can you remember when you first heard that there might be a problem with 3 Mile Island?
Yes, it was Wednesday morning. And I went over to the development office or something, and one of the secretaries over there said, "What do you think of the accident at 3 Mile Island? And I don't pay much attention to the news media in the mornings because I'm so busy. So I had no idea, and I said, "Well, what's going on?" They said, "Well, I think they had a bad accident over there, and they've spilled some radiation." So when I came back to my office, I asked some of the people here in the physics department if they'd heard, and Neil Wolf had gotten wind, I don't know how, and we turned on the radio, and at that time, WITF was carrying a press conference which involved DER representatives being asked by the media what they were doing about monitoring the radiation. And they were, the spokesman for DER, I recall, as being very halting and really putting his foot in his mouth rather wildly. It was interesting because he was, they were saying, "Are your men out monitoring to find out how much radiation?" "No, we don't have any equipment." "Well, what are your men doing?" "Well, they're sitting in the office with the Met Ed people drinking coffee." But Met Ed has assured us.
It's stimulating public confidence. Huh?
That's when I started following
the attention. Did you pay attention to the media thereafter then?
Yes, I started following it. I was concerned about what I was looking at newspapers during the next week, you know, very carefully listening to the radio first thing every morning,
more
watching much
usual.
More attention, yes. Mm-hmm.
In television?
Yes, in the evenings.
Okay. Did you know there was a reactor there before the incident?
Oh, yes.
How far is 3 Mile Island from that?
It's 22 and a half miles. But as the crow flies, that's mm-hmm. about road miles.
Now, your initial reaction, how did you feel? Did you feel it was a serious situation?
I was concerned, but I certainly, it wasn't until Friday afternoon, or actually Friday morning, that I thought that things might get out of control.
In other words, your opinion changed somewhat. You got more concerned as time went on.
Yes.
What led you to be more concerned about the problem?
Well, Friday morning, there was another large radiation release, and it was one of the largest. And it was reported as uncontrolled, and pregnant women at that point and young children were asked to leave the area. So John Lutzelswab and I put a bunch of monitoring equipment in his car and went down there. And we, at York Haven, we were picking up 4 and 5 times background in the air dose. And we got some more soil samples. I've worked with radiation since I was an undergraduate in college for research. And I'm familiar with monitoring health and safety procedures. I was a radiation control officer at Bryn Mawr College to supplement my graduate income. It involved taking monitoring on a regular basis, all the departments that use radiation, and going into the room where radiation was stored and seeing that it was stored properly, that things were disposed of properly. And this is for radioisotopes, so mm-hmm. I have some background in this mm-hmm. area.
So you were immediately attempting to... why did you go down to monitor?
We wanted to... I felt that it was important for two reasons. One is I didn't... wasn't sure about all these conflicting reports, and I felt that it would be valuable for me and for the community to have some independent assessments. Now, there is a lot of uncertainty when one is doing monitoring, and when you talk about an independent assessment, it's not a matter of making an accurate judgment, but it's a matter of distinguishing between people who are saying, well, there are no radiation levels, and people who were giving shocking figures for what might be happening by over...
You were hearing this on the media?
Yeah, by overplaying things like the measurements in the stack, which is not where anybody is. And so that was one thing. The other thing is that John Lutzelswab is set up rather uniquely to do very careful soil monitoring. It's a line of research that he is He'd started as an undergraduate when they were looking at fallout components in soils. He's had students here doing some research, and he had all the instrumentation set up so that he was able to
swing right into
seeing at least what might be deposited out in the soil. And actually, Thursday morning he picked up a soil sample, and by that afternoon we knew we had some xenon gas in it, because it had been right after a rainfall.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of fun for me because it was a mystery peak, and I had ended up identifying it while John was gone, and it felt good.
Mm-hmm. So then did you continue to do this monitoring?
Yes. I focused. John collected most of the soil samples because he lives down there, and Lisa Powowski coordinated student volunteers, and I sort of supervised the things here. It largely involved for me keeping people consistent about what they were doing, because everybody was running around in circles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hard for me to keep from running around in circles because people, the press was calling here for information, and people were calling here for reassurances, and so that all our phone lines were tied up and people were running in and out of the building wildly wanting to know what was going on. But I remember sending some students over, especially Friday morning when I knew we were going to have to start monitoring more consistently, for a lab notebook. And I started setting up a procedure for what we were going to keep records of. And I remember feeling that was very important. And I remember the sensation of forcing myself to slow down so that I would stay rational about what was needed. And I went almost into low gear, into a semi-catatonic state in order to...
This is because of the reactions of other people.
Yeah.
Who were calling? Do you have any sense of that population?
Citizens
from the town?
From the town, people from the local media,
mm-hmm.
little newspapers and
mm-hmm.
things like the West Shore Times and the Guide and... the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was calling about. John had called NetEd to tell them that we were doing the monitoring because he had contacts, and they had called somebody from NRC. And since he was in and out, the guy from NRC would call back and say, well, we're particularly concerned about certain aspects of your monitoring, that you do this or that, and we have to incorporate that into our record keeping system. The other thing we did on Friday was to set up a Geiger counter, which would notice any changes from normal background as a function of time, and call the radio stations regularly just to help reassure people in the community, or at least to have people in the community know that things were going on. The other main call on our time was that the county commissioners were calling and wanting us to be a committee to advise them. And I remember at the time I was very nervous because they wanted us to advise them about when evacuation might take place and what the criteria should be, and I felt totally unprepared to help them make that decision on a crisis basis. I think I have the kind of background that might help if I had a month or so to study the situation and think it over and look at the pros and cons to help with those sorts of judgments, but I didn't think they ought to be being made at the county level, and I felt that federal officials would be in a better position to have the expertise, because it has to do with the meld of civil defense, and there are a lot of costs and benefits of evacuation. People can die in automobile accidents and so on. But I remember I did go down to the courthouse and talk to John Brugios and brief him on health effects of radiation. You know, what might be the consequences of not evacuating under certain circumstances,
mm-hmm.
in terms of long-term effects of low level, not a major blowout where we have high level contamination, but where's the trade-off point?
Mm-hmm.
When do you start moving a community?
But where are you to making this trade-off?
Excuse me, the business office is on the phone.
No, I felt very uncomfortable, unqualified to make those kinds of decisions. I was aware of the fact that the local civil defense agencies were totally unprepared for this sort of thing. Neil was working with them. They had a few survey meters. Nobody knew how to use them. The batteries were all dead. Even if they'd known how to use them, they wouldn't know how to interpret the readings, and so on down the line. So I spent a couple hours over there after talking with John Brugios making out some little charts as to how long a person could stay at each needle setting without exceeding occupation or exposure limits if they were to send people in for fire and police protection mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. case of evacuation, things of this nature.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a matter of being simple-minded things where we would like draw a picture. If the needle is here on the average and it's going to verbal around, you write it in a note, you can stay in X number of hours, and if the needle is here, you can stay in Y number of hours and things like that. And it was just quite a revelation to realize how totally unprepared
mm-hmm.
would have been handling had it been worse.
You might go on with that a little bit, because now you're talking about some interaction you're having with government agencies. How did you feel government agencies at each level were responding? Were they responding appropriately, or were they...
I think it's a little hard for me to give you an accurate overview of that, because I was aware of the fact I had called people at the Bureau of Radiological Health by early the next week after that weekend. And I was quite aware of the fact
that federally.
Yes, that every government agency from local through federal that had anything to do either with radiation or being in the local area was working full time. I was just galled by the disruption of the whole thing. That is to say, when my contacts are with the Bureau of Radiological Health, and they are primarily responsible for regulating radiation in consumer products and medical and dental uses, and have nothing to do with nuclear power. But because they have monitoring equipment and expertise, every single person in the Bureau who knew anything about calculating doses or monitoring was called in.
Was up here in Harrisburg?
Up to Harrisburg, or to work down in the office down there assessing the information that was being fed in almost on a 24-hour-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, you know, like a side agency. They weren't the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think people realize this, because the same thing was true for the Environmental Protection Agency
mm-hmm.
and for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and so on. And it turned out, you see, that the person I've been collaborating with for the last few years had been on this interagency task force to assess the doses. And they were pulling all-nighters and working weekends and evenings for a good month after the accident,
mm-hmm.
putting together that report
mm-hmm.
Because they felt it was important to
have
get it out.
Yeah.
And that was a group of 8 or 10 people, probably with an equal number of staff support people.
Mm-hmm. Are you willing to speak to the question of the function of the media in all of this? Do you have some opinions about that?
Yes. I had expressed those, I guess, in some of the open meetings, that one of the real dangers in this kind of situation is a panic, because I think a panic population can hurt itself. And I did feel that the media exaggerated a lot of things, partly because radiation and how one interprets information about radiation is very complex. It's frighteningly technical, and it underlies, I think, one of my major concerns about certain kinds of technologies. I mean, that's getting a little off the subject, but I am very much of the Schumacher school of thought, the small is beautiful, or that people ought to look toward technologies that one doesn't have to be highly sophisticated to understand. And I think the example of Three Mile Island is precisely an example of an extremely capital-intensive, complex technology. And it's very hard for even experts to coordinate on a crisis basis
mm-hmm.
in understanding information, so that I can't, in a sense, blame the media. I don't want to point my finger and say the media is irresponsible. I think the media could have been more responsible on the one hand, but on the other hand, I think part of the inability to interpret complex information correctly on a crisis basis is fundamental. The fundamental flaw of the technology.
Okay. You feel that the, what about the industry? You feel that they were...
I think the industry has its head in the clouds.
Go ahead.
Well, my first contact with the Three Mile Island people was in about 1970, when we invited two health physicists over to talk to a little group we had here called the Science Information Group, and we were trying to learn about environmental problems, and we wanted them to talk about the reactor which was then being built. This was Unit 1, and what they considered to be the potential health problems, both for occupational, on an occupational basis, for people working around it, and for the citizens, and what kind of radiation is going into the environment. And a lot of us were environmentalists, and they knew it. So they were a little on edge. And one of the health physicists was making statements like, well, I've been working around reactors for years, and I've gotten much more radiation than the population will ever get, and my children are perfectly normal. At which point, Paul Beeble in the biology department hit the ceiling, because there are a lot of genetic effects which are recessive and don't express themselves to future generations. And most of the risks of low-level exposure are what we call stochastic, and that means that you don't know which individual is going to be affected in an exposed population, so that you can't go around with the example of one saying, I'm perfectly normal and I've had a lot of radiation, and it doesn't mean anything. And I felt that somebody who is educated and working for the industry and whose profession is health physics, the protection of workers and the population, should know better.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that kind of naivete runs right through the industry from top to bottom.
Did you feel in the particular incident, now that you said you started...
Well, what I'm saying is that I think...
That this is built...
I think this is just an example of their thinking, the
mm-hmm.
level of their thinking, and I would rather have people call a spade a spade.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying, we have a technology that has some benefits and some risks, and obviously if somebody's been actively for Metropolitan Edison with a nuclear reactor... Unless they have no scruples at all, they've made a decision that the benefits outweigh the risks. But and they have a right to their opinion, and I think to articulating their belief. But I think the belief needs to be based on a recognition that it is not a black and white situation.
Mm-hmm. And you felt that the industry performed in that way throughout the incident, the
yes.
same way?
Yes.
Can you give some examples?
Well, I can't give entirely examples from MetEd. I've been to MetEd several times and have picked up that same attitude
mm-hmm.
When we're over there talking with them about the setup. Another example is that the first time we visited Unit 1, it was in operation, so we could not go in the reactor building, but they showed us the health physics section, their monitoring equipment. They describe their procedures for when workers go into work in the hot areas and what kind of, they wear suits and air masks and various things, and how they check to see that they're not contaminated when they come out. And we said, well, what about radiation emergencies and various things? How would you handle that? Because I was concerned about incidents. And they said, well, we have so much regulation and so many backup systems that you would never have to worry. For example, and they pointed to a shelf that's about this much material here, and they said, in all of these binders here, we have a set of procedures for what to do in case of emergency. And I looked at those binders and I thought to myself, who is going to have time to read all those procedures in emergencies? Because it's obviously an IBM-like thing where you say, if thing X happens, go to manual Y and look on page 79, paragraph 2. And then it says on paragraph 2, if the radiation level is above this, go to manual 78, paragraph 99, and so on. And you can't imagine. I just thought it was naive to wave at a huge shelf full of binders. which is just an example of the complexity
of the system.
Yeah. I mean, when you visit a reactor facility, it is enormous, and the complexity I found overwhelming. I visited the Unit 2 reactor, and when it was about 98% constructed, and John Witzelsrob got us a tour, and we were able to go inside, and it was really fascinating. I was glad to have had that visit because I have an image of what the inside of that building looks like, mm-hmm. which most people don't. Mm-hmm. And the walls at the entrances at the base are 8 feet thick concrete on the outside containment vessel. And I think that's what made me feel that any kind of chemical explosion was not going to blow the building up.
Okay.
And release radiation to the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. I felt it's been overbuilt because of its proximity to the airport.
Mm-hmm.
There are other ways for radiation to leak, and I had other concerns. But I just exposure to the people at MedEd, plus following the kind of stupid stuff that comes out of an organization called the Atomic Industrial Forum, which is an industry mouthpiece about nuclear power is wonderful. You know, everything is so incredibly one-sided. Now, I have seen examples, on the other hand, of environmental groups exaggerating as much in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
And, so there is a tremendous amount of polarization about the issue. I mean, just there's a gal named Helen Caldicott, who's an MD, who I've seen on film, who will say, well, all it takes is one particle of ionizing radiation to completely destroy a human being. That is true. But taken out of context, it's a totally misleading statement.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to take you back. We got to Friday. You got more concerned on Friday. Was that the height of the level of your concern? Or?
The height of the level of my concern was probably from about 5 o'clock Friday until midday Sunday.
What happened midday Sunday?
I think the stasis of the situation, the fact that I was living with the crisis and mm-hmm. I had to relax and nothing had happened yet
mm-hmm.
with the bubble. It felt that, and they had had more time to be thinking about it, so I became a little more hopeful that they would be able to cope with it without a major.
Because the thing itself, even though not in a great condition, was stable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you recall when you came away from that tantrum?
I don't think any of us, well, I can't speak for other people, but it dwindled. It wasn't, there wasn't a dramatic, now everything's all right, you
mm-hmm.
can relax.
Mm-hmm.
People, I think, started relaxing very slowly.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the people that were handling that situation over there, do you think they were in control of it?
I don't know. I was very glad that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission people came up. I felt that they probably ought to have more expertise than local people.
Mm-hmm.
Not perhaps as much knowledge of the exact workings of the plant, but a more broad knowledge of the kinds of things that can go wrong with reactors, and also less, in a way, at stake in trying to save face.
Would you say then that of the people operative in the situation, they were the people you trusted most?
Yeah, somebody like Harold Benton.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it, the thing that built my confidence in Denton was that he seemed like a very down-to-earth person, and although he probably got too technical for many people, he got up there and said what he knew. He didn't talk down to people. He didn't say, now you people won't understand all this, but you're all right, which is the attitude that Matt Edison had.
Mm-hmm.
Now, kiddies, let us take care of it.
Would you say that of the people involved, that those are the people that you mistrusted most?
Yes, I guess so.
Do you think they're in control of the situation now?
Well, I think it's like the reactor's gotten cool enough.
I'd ask you if you felt they were in control of the situation now.
I think the situation is being monitored more carefully by the NRC, and that it's a less critical situation because the thing is shut down.
Mm-hmm.
So that we may have some more radiation releases. You know, there's quite a flap about sort of slipping a few things in the drinking water for the Lancaster
mm-hmm.
area.
Mm-hmm.
But and they're going to have more radiation releases as they clean up. I know it. It's a mess.
Mm-hmm.
I just know this from little rinky-dink Bryn Mawr. It's probably the smallest graduate school in the country, and you get a little radiation spill, and it's invisible, and it's really hard to decontaminate.
Mm-hmm.
And I just imagine, try to multiply this by the scale of that plant.
Yeah. Yeah. I've asked this in several different ways, but maybe you can pinpoint it. In the total situation, what worried you most about what was going on over there?
I guess the possibility of the meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I wasn't so worried about a hydrogen explosion unless it, you know, being very damaging, unless somehow it triggered the chain of events that would lead to the meltdown.
What would a meltdown do?
Well, we've heard different scenarios, and I really, one of the things I did was, Saturday, after meeting with the senior staff and being asked for what should we do about the college, I came over here and tried to dig out materials on scenarios, and I found the materials very scant, especially the federal materials. And there were some more vivid scenarios in some of the environmental books that I have, and environmental studies and textbooks and things in there. There's one here on, where did I put it, on nuclear power that's meant for, or nuclear energy and physics and social challenge, that has quite an illuminating discussion. It's written by a physicist. It starts out by describing other near accidents
mm-hmm.
in detail, and then talks about some things about meltdown, and there were two major things that I got out of what he said, if they could be relied upon, was just one reference, and realizing the uncertainty of single people creating these scenarios. One of them was that it would not be an explosion. That it, the idea of the thing melting down through the bottom could start contaminating the river quite badly, and I would feel very sorry for the Chesapeake Bay and any people living downriver, but would probably not be a tremendous burden to the Carlisle community.
Mm-hmm.
So that I saw this stuff seething into the groundwater that was going to flow downstream from our community, not something splatting radiation on us. The second thing was, though, that the point was made that the radiation levels would be much higher than one would expect in an equivalent amount of fission in a bomb, because of the mix of products are different in a reactor than a bomb. And because the reactor has been burning, in a sense the nuclear burning has been taking place over a period of months, it has built up fission products. Whereas in a bomb, whatever is created at the moment of explosion and dispersed. And so this thing is holding a lot of waste,
mm-hmm.
in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point was made that in terms of radiation levels, there's more radiation in that core than there would be in a bomb,
mm-hmm.
and even the larger ones.
So although it wouldn't go all over the place, it would be a heavier
would be a much bigger burden there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that I was really starting to feel very sad about the possibility of contaminating central Pennsylvania, but not threatened in terms of my immediate welfare or the welfare of people in the community. I felt, I always felt people could get out.
Did you have any mental images of what this would look like if it happened?
Well, yes, and the mental image, I realized, was not a rational one. This is the sort of thing you're talking about. It was like after a bomb had been dropped and all, there were no leaves on trees and things looked gray. You know, central Pennsylvania, sort of this area around the plant looked devastated. Not piles of rubble so much as just silent devastation.
Quiet.
Quiet, but you know,
animal life. What about people and animal life?
Gone. And people and animal life gone, leaves off trees, you know, just bare branches, and everything a gray color.
Did you make any plans different from what you ordinarily would have?
Well, my time was totally wrapped up in trying to answer questions to keep the monitoring going here and meeting with the senior staff.
Okay,
and
now we might go to that now.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that I did not make plans to evacuate. We made no, we didn't pack any suitcases. We didn't do anything about that. But certainly my life was quite different, as it was everyone's.
Okay, that we might go to that now, because that's that will probably take in some of the other questions. How did this affect your work?
I didn't get any work done, except insofar as being a physicist, I was doing physics.
Okay, you might go on with that. Rather than what you usually do as a physicist, you were doing something else. Okay, you were saying that you didn't make plans to leave the area or anything
that's right.
like that. Did you ever think about possibility of leaving the area?
No.
How did you feel about people who did?
Well, I had mixed feelings, because the first thing that happened was that Friday night, I saw people leaving the Middletown area when we were going down to monitor. I just remember passing farmhouses and people were loading up their cars and putting suitcases in their trunk, and just I have an image of that. And the place was eerie because there were no people walking around when we got to Goldsboro. And there was nobody out on the street, a couple of state policemen. And I felt that under the circumstances, if I had not been a physicist and if I had been living within a couple of miles of the plant, I certainly would have left. And that seemed very sensible to me. When I came back to campus, we called from John Litzelschwab's office, called the president's office, and suggested, since we were doing some monitoring, that we at least report on what we were finding as independent, because I could tell that the media was getting a little wild, to the college. And I expected a group of maybe 50 people to show up who were interested, and was totally unprepared to be confronted with essentially everybody who'd heard about the possibility that somebody was going to give them some new information being on hand. And that was the point. I don't know if you were at that meeting on Friday night, but people were asking me, should they leave? And I said, at that point, if you feel more comfortable leaving, by all means, leave. And I remember George Allen feeling that it was not ethical to consider leaving without civil instruction, because one could start a mass panic. Well, what had happened instead was a trickle-out, which is really safer. So that I think, in very practical terms, that it was a good thing for some people to leave. I think also the people who are most nervous about the situation are, it's better to have them off the scene if you're going to have an evacuation anyway.
Okay.
So I think there's some, you know, taking into account a range of feelings. I think, knowing what I know, it didn't make very much sense for people to leave Carlisle. But I understood the uncertainties, and that they were perfectly legitimate.
Okay. Now, we're going to go back. I wanted to pick that up just before we went on with how this affected your ordinary routines.
Well, I was staying up late at night. I was on edge emotionally. I was excited. I was a little scared. I think the thing that scared me a lot was a sense of responsibility, that people were depending on me to make some judgments, and suppose I was just totally out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
And by Saturday afternoon or Sunday, I called my advisor at Bryn Mawr, who'd worked on the Manhattan Project and had worked with high levels of radiation, and I just went over my thinking with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he concurred with my thinking, and I felt a little better just to have some buddy who I felt had some direct experience.
Mm-hmm.
My family played a sick joke on me, and I don't know if I told you about it, but Sunday was April Fool's Day, and I was over here at a meeting or talking to people till late at night, and my son and my husband made a little tape that I didn't know about, and the next morning at breakfast, we were having our traditional Sunday morning pancakes, which we didn't give up, and Ken said, let's have a little music. We all need to relax. And so we do that a lot on Sunday morning. We'll turn on WITF. So he turned on this Baroque music, and we were eating breakfast, and it was all very soothing. And I was getting ready to go to another senior staff meeting later that morning, and just finishing breakfast, and all of a sudden there was this, this is WITF radio. We regret to have to interrupt this music broadcast with an important message. There has been a complete core meltdown at Three Mile Island, and there is a large mass of radiation moving with the prevailing winds toward Carlisle, Pennsylvania, especially toward 136 North College.
By this time you're picking up.
Where an April Fool resides. And I took the joke fairly well. As the thing was emerging, before I caught on to the joke, I was thinking, I have got to call President Banks about the college. Because I had been engaged with the process of planning for the college, it was my first calling. And so I was just about to get up and charge toward the phone, you know, but I had to listen to a little more message, and by that time the joke was revealed. And then I had a good laugh. And then I got up to start doing the dishes, and I realized that the adrenaline was running all through my body. I was just...
mm-hmm.
So that was...
You might talk now then, too, a little about that. You, in the course of this 3 or 4 day period, you're very tied up with college making decisions, right?
Yeah.
What was going on there?
Have you interviewed any of the senior staff?
No.
Yeah, okay. My perception. Let me see. Friday or Thursday, John became the spokesman. He was the department chairman, and he went in and reassured the president. And then the president requested that Neil and John and I meet with the senior staff on Saturday morning. And that was the first time I was asked officially for my opinion on anything. And I shouldn't talk. I really had probably been asked not to talk too much about the meeting, but I think just, you know, the internal workings. The major concern of the meeting was, should we close down the college? Would we be endangering the safety of the students? And I felt that very appreciative of Banks' approach. I gained respect for him that I hadn't had before. I don't want to be quoted on this, and you know, this is the part where things are confidential in terms of you know, having anything attributed to me, but I've always Chadha thinks of somebody who simply talks so much that he never listens to what anybody is saying. And what he did that Saturday morning was to organize the meeting in such a way that we started talking about the technical factors first, and then built up to the impact on the community of various actions on the basis of those technical factors, and he forced people to listen to everyone. And what he did not talk a lot, except to direct the meeting. He asked the physicists first what they thought was the problem with the plant, and if they could estimate the probabilities of various things happening, what the consequences of those things would be. If anybody in the then asked if anybody in the senior staff had anything to add on that topic, on what are we going to do about the students and the phone calls coming in and the other things. And what happened was that certain senior staff members came with this immediacy of parents calling them, wanting this and that. And they wanted to interject that into the situation. You know, we must do X, Y, or Z because... And Banks would say, wait, we will hear that, and we want to take that into consideration as part of the decision. And then we went into the next layer of, you know, what are the options for what we ought to do about things, what are the consequences of doing these things, and how do they fit into the responses of parents, students, and other people. And I felt that it was an excellent way to work out the decision. And at that point, the decision was that we were not endangering students and we would keep the college open. Again, when the senior staff met on Sunday, the problem became that so many students had left campus, and now parents were calling Sunday morning saying, should I send my son or daughter back? If you're still open, can you guarantee that you'll be mounting classes? And we felt that people would be very angry driving 5 or 6 miles from hours from Connecticut and various places to find that so many people had taken off, and that we had heard then at that point that a number of faculty members had taken off. I do know that certain people in the college administration were very annoyed that faculty members had taken off, very angry about it in the crisis situation. And they seemed more annoyed that they had not informed somebody higher up in their hierarchy, whether it was the dean or their department chairperson or what have you. So that it wasn't so much the fact that somebody... I didn't get a feeling that it was because people who took off were chickens. It was because it was irresponsible when one had an obligation to an institution that had not closed down not to inform. Okay. So that came out, and that was a factor in closing down the college. I don't think that we necessarily would have stayed open if faculty had been here because of the number of students, but it became a factor.
Let's see, where were we? Oh, you were talking about decision making at the college and so forth.
Oh, about the faculty.
And the faculty, yes.
And there was some friction in
that. Do you have any sense of how many did leave?
The rumor was about 20. That was a rumor.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, at that point, this was Sunday morning, and a lot of it was hearsay. There might have been more who'd taken off, and nobody knew about it. There might have been fewer because somebody had heard that so-and-so was thinking of taking off.
And some gone, and some come back, mm-hmm. and so forth, and so on.
Some gone for the weekend.
In other words, there was no really accurate information.
That's correct.
Was there really accurate information on that student body?
Fairly accurate because of the dormitory counts. They were doing, Dean Wall was feeding, he was not at the meetings, but he was responsible for seeing that people went in and took us.
Now let's see, I'm going to shift to a little bit different form of question. Do you think that anything that happened at Three Mile Island might have affected your health?
No, except the stress. I don't think there would be any directly. I don't think anything about radiation
caused.
Even though I was down. Well, let me put it this way. I was down in increased radiation for a while, but I've been that way in research settings before. And the probability the added risk over the radiation I normally absorb, I consider negligible.
Okay. Do you think that it affected other aspects of your life or of the life of the community?
I think it's affected the life of the community.
Can you speak more?
Yeah, I think having experienced, and this is on an emotional level, the uncertainties, the unpreparedness on Three Mile Island, I think people are a lot more sober about the notion that energy use and technologies are simply beneficial, and that the risks can just be taken care of by the experts.
Mm-hmm.
Then it'll all be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I think people are a lot more suspicious. I don't think people have made the kind of fundamental changes in their outlook toward how one handles these things that's going to be necessary to make substantial changes. That is to say, I think unless people get a lot more sophisticated about energy and what they're going to need in the future and participate a lot more, and I don't see that emerging particularly, I don't think that they're going to affect the situation terribly. Now, that's a kind of pessimistic thing to say,
mm-hmm.
but, for example, I think Three Mile Island is going to go back online, both units, I predict.
Hmm.
And the reason I predict it is that I have worked with tremendous logic for environmental things that don't make good sense politically in terms of whose pockets are being lined and where the power is. And this country is run not on logic, but on the basis of the special interest groups. And the special interest groups are become expert and dogged and very persuasive to in the proportion to which they have dollars behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And this means, for example, my example is the bottle bill, where none of us have much stake in throwing away a couple of bottles a day or what have you. And it mounts up because it's a nationwide thing. But the bottle industry, it's a $4 billion industry. If a group of environmentalists wants to spend $100,000 on a campaign to get a bottle bill in a community, the industry will spend $1 million, whatever it takes. And the atomic energy, the nuclear energy industry is going to spend whatever it takes to get that plant back online, because they have invested $1 billion in Unit 2 in the first place. And until it costs more than $1 billion to fix it up, they're not going to throw it away.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any concern about the food or the milk from your...
Because I knew the level. They're low.
Now, you've talked about the one metal in which you had if the worst had occurred there and so forth. Did you have any other pictures in your mind of the effects of radiation on life?
No, I've thought a lot about what it's like to have cancer, because I've worked
mm-hmm.
on these, you know, read descriptions of what kinds of cancers, what are the most radiosensitive organs, what kinds of cancers and things. But I didn't go through any detailed thinking about the cancers. I just knew there was cancer and genetic
problems. And it just was a possibility. Yeah. If
the other thing is, it's very difficult for me to get specific, like the flipper image or anything, because I had just that a couple months before been pouring through some 2,000 genetic diseases and their codes, and I have a list of them. And there are so many of them that it's very hard for me to have a stereotype of the genetic
mm-hmm.
deformity.
Mm-hmm. Did you think of your own death at any point?
No.
That of others?
I thought of the possibility of a few people getting radiation sickness and perhaps death in the event of a meltdown, and I thought mostly of workers and people living as close as possible to the plant.
Mm-hmm.
I when I go through those scenarios, and I didn't dwell on it a lot, I think of a book by John Hersey called Hiroshima, in which he describes a group of people after the blast being refugees, leaving the town and being by a riverbank and starting to get nauseous and have diarrhea and the symptoms of it, and they had no idea why they would be getting sick in that way. And then people started dying. And so I guess I think of that description.
Did you think of God during the incident?
No, because I'm not religious.
You've talked a lot about what you were doing. You've talked a lot about certain feeling, certain kinds of responsibilities. Could you enlarge on those? I mean, did you feel certain particular responsibilities in the situation?
Well, the only particular... Well, I guess I felt responsibilities along two lines. And then I had been asked to speak to people here at Dickinson, and I had been asked to go to the high school and talk about radiation. And I felt somehow I was reassuring people, and I felt... I would have felt very bad if... for some reason we had misread our monitoring and misinterpreted the way I put together the information that was coming in, and there was radiation in the community and people should have left.
So you felt a strong sense of the desire and need to be accurate in this case and wanting to feel confident about what you were advising.
I also felt though that I didn't have any stake in advising one thing or another. I felt that Med-Ed and even the NRC in a way needed to save face and make the accident as minimal as possible. And that the media wanted to sell newspapers and have people listen to the news and wanted to have a stake in making the information as exciting as possible.
And so you felt yourself in a more objective position.
I felt myself in a more objective position, and I've often felt that that's the advantage of being academic.
Did you ever feel any conflicting responsibilities?
I don't think so. I felt funny about being reassuring in the sense that I have been very concerned about radiation, but I did honestly feel that the radiation is lower than medical radiation, and if anything, it reaffirms my conviction that people are pretty foolish about medical radiation and overreacting. Not overreacting. I shouldn't say people have overreacted in some ways, because the problem is that one's reactions to that whole incident are complicated by fear of radiation, fears of explosion, fears of catastrophes that might have happened. And I felt the same thing, that one gets a jumble of emotions and it becomes very difficult to sort out and say, now look here, this wasn't a problem. Well, you can say that only in the sense that so far I don't think we've been exposed to too much radiation, but that's the only thing you can say, and then it gets complicated by this possibility of nothing.
You've said a good bit about things that you had to do which you otherwise would not have been involved in doing. Can you think of anything else there?
Well, I had some television interviews afterwards. And I felt... I gave you that medical information.
Right.
Carl Strang went with me, and he has a good background in biology, but not specifically in radiation. So he talked a little bit about ecology, but he doesn't have the kind of feel that one gets for what different doses means. That takes, I think, months and years to acquire, working with it. And the radiologist who was on the show was a little bit like the Metropolitan Edison guy who said, I've been exposed and my children are perfectly normal. He's a radiation therapist, and he was really ignorant about long-term effects of low-level radiation, which is what we're talking about. He's not ignorant about radiation sickness and what levels it takes to induce those, but he had a very on-off notion that you get at those levels and you might have problems, and below those levels there's absolutely nothing that can happen. And So I felt that it was difficult to be on the show because I felt that I was the only one who knew what I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Did you see the show?
No, I did not. Yeah. I'm sure we have it on tape. I mean, we were taping.
Right. So it was a a problem.
You've mentioned that at least one person you were dealing with in the course of this had a notion about the ethics of behavior in the situation.
So right.
Did you have an ethical set of ethical stances that informed the way you're behaving in the situation and so forth?
Well, I've been in emergency situations before. I counseled at a Girl Scout camp in Yosemite. In two different summers, we had forest fire threats that involved evacuating the camp, involved things like guarding the camp in case looters came back. And I think it's really important to take time to think in emergencies. And I get upset when... Well, I guess I felt it was important to keep thinking as logically as possible,
mm-hmm.
you know, knowing that I was emotional,
mm-hmm.
as was everyone, and that was a normal situation. So I guess I didn't disapprove, or I guess I felt I understood that some people got very panicked, but I also felt that I wished that more people would take time to learn more as they go instead of saying, I don't have time to learn anything. So,
where did you see the pen? What groups of people?
It's personalities. Neil got more panicked than the rest of us. I thought John stayed too calm, but that's because I was in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we always think... Yeah.
Did you see others?
Yeah. I think, in general, I noted that the whole modern languages department left and thought about the different personalities. And I said, you start later, you know, you're reflecting, you start doing a little bit of analysis. Well, you'd expect certain people to leave.
Mm-hmm. Just their basic personality structure would leave that,
yeah.
Leave that one?
Yeah. And I think, in a way, that's okay. You can't have everybody being an Indian chief in an emergency. And as long as panicked people... I didn't see panicked people getting in people's way in the situation too much.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little bit... I think I had some frictions with people. I think Charlie Seller got so tired that he stopped at some point sorting out the pros and cons of different courses of action. But I also appreciated the fact that I was going to bed every night and sleeping, even though I was probably not sleeping as well. And he was up like for a couple nights, 24 hours in a row, answering parent inquiries and feeling their panic and dealing with it, so that he came away with a different perception. And I don't think it was so much, I didn't sense that Charlie has a panic personality, but that his... The world of experience that he was pulled into, and the lack of rest made it more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You might speak to about that. You said you were sleeping every night. Was your sleep disturbed?
I think I woke up once a night on the average.
That you wouldn't have ordinarily?
Yeah.
Do you have any dreams?
Not that I recall. But I might have, you know, I have dreams and I forget them, and I didn't have anything that was so vivid that I remember.
Mm-hmm.
This part of the I remember I'd wake up a little early in the mornings and be sure that we heard the morning news. I was hungry to get that first report on the radio that, you know, what was going on. Was radiation moving toward us because we'd had a meltdown, or were things still the same? And so that was a big change for me.
You were more alert than usual. Being
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would have sprung out of bed if somebody tapped me on the shoulder, I suppose. I wasn't quite that bad. I don't usually have difficulty sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not easy to keep me up all night.
You have already talked about one set of past experiences that you made analogous to this, the forest fire business. Did you think about that during that time?
A little bit, yeah.
Was there any other past experience that you've had that fed into this? That you remember remembering at that time?
No, forest fire thing, and the thing that I remember even telling somebody at the time, one of the senior staff member meetings when we were having a break about the forest fire thing, was that I'm aware of the role that my emotions might play to the extent that I sometimes devise methods for guarding against the dangers that they present. Now, an example I can give of this is that when I was at the Girl Scout camp, there were about six of us on a central staff. I was teaching swimming. So that we evacuated the camp and all the unit leaders and counselors stayed with the girls. And the director and myself and a couple of other central staff members went back to the camp to guard it against looters. And we were in the camp lodge, and we had a fire going, and we'd agreed that we'd have two-hour shifts. And each of us would stay awake for 2 hours, and the rest of us were exhausted and hadn't gotten the girls out there after me. And we had no weapons except an axe. And so somebody plunked the axe by the fireplace and said, all right, now when you're on your shift, keep the fire going. You know, if you hear any funny noises, there's the axe. Okay. When it was my turn, I did not want responsibility for getting panicked and clobbering. You know, if a prisoner, we had heard some prisoners had escaped. Okay. If a prisoner walked in, I did not want to clobber that person with an axe. Okay. But on the other hand, I wanted to do something about it. So I replaced the axe with a broom. Now, that sounds funny, but just this idea, you know, that this moment might happen in which I'm gripped with fear.
You were talking about past experiences. You finished your story about the axe and
yeah.
So forth. If not past experiences, you mentioned Hiroshima more and more.
Not Hiroshima Mon Amour.
No, the book Hiroshima.
Hiroshima. I saw Hiroshima Mon Amour, but I did not think about, like, I remember the vivid scenes in that movie with the radiation burns and things. I didn't think
about that. You didn't think about them. Did you think of any, are there any historical events?
I thought of Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't dwell on it.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that this sort of an accident or incident was more or less frightening than, say, a flood or a hurricane?
I think it was more frightening, even though probably a hurricane or a flood, I mean, clearly, look at something like Agnes, did more damage.
What do you think more frightening?
Let's say the flood did more physical damage. I think that the Three Mile Island did more psychological damage.
Mm-hmm.
People know what to do about floods. They can see the water. Nobody is lying to them. They don't feel people have power over them in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
There are some of the same elements. There's if people leave an area because they're afraid their home will be flooded, that it might be looted. There were, you know, the same fears that one gets in the thought of evacuation and what happens in a community. There were some fires that couldn't be put out because firefighting equipment couldn't get to the places. I remember that distinctly in Agnes. But the onslaught of water is a visible thing, and one has a feeling that you can make your own decision about when it's time to leave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if your stuff will be destroyed, you're making your own decisions about personal safety. You're having to depend on somebody to tell you it's time to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know what criteria they're using.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know for sure whether they're really telling you the truth about, or they've measured correctly what's there. Whereas with the water, there it is.
Mm-hmm. So it's invisibility is probably one of the chief problems.
And unpredictability. In a way, a flood is unpredictable. You don't know how long it's going to continue raining. But they could say in the flood, if the rain continues like this for X more hours, the rivers will crest at such and such a time. There's more of a handle
mm-hmm.
that one gets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I just And I know Agnes probably did much more physical damage. But psychological damage can cost money. And mm-hmm. I think people have to recognize that. In stress diseases, in the disruption of normal productive days that people have that are erased, the general wear and tear, in the money spent, that when people who evacuated, nobody's going to pay them back for going to a motel or their gas or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So there are all of those things.
Because. Mm-hmm. Did you think of any TV shows or movies?
No.
Find yourself singing any song?
Mm-mm.
Oh yeah, HP crew was all singing We'll Meet Again. Do you have any daydreams that you remember?
No, not that I remember. I'm sure I had daydreams. I always do. But I'm...
Do you think of any other books than the Hiroshima Mercy book?
No.
Did you notice people changing around you? You've said a fair amount about that already, their heightened emotionality and so forth. Is there any reasons?
Things like John. John, this is why he stutters when he gets nervous, but he's always very calm on the surface. And he started stuttering.
So that'd be the only indication. Only somebody who would know him would know that that was an indication of his feeling some stress and so forth.
Yeah.
Do you think this changed individuals in any lasting way? Now, you have spoken to how it's changed the community in terms of its attitudes and its faith in people and that sort of thing.
Yeah, the faith in technology and complex technology and so on. I felt, though, I went down to the Washington protest in early May.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was talking about ending nuclear power. And nobody was talking consistently about alternatives. I mean, everybody would have their own different alternative or what have you. And I guess, people go through stages, and my problem is I've thought about all these things before anyway. So I expect people to be at the stage of saying, if you're going to have alternatives, what are they? Are you going to use less energy? Are you going to put up with air pollution from coal? Are you going to put up with international tensions that you're going to get by depending on Iranian oil? Are you going to, and I mm-hmm. want people to do this kind of thinking so
mm-hmm.
badly.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see it yet, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I think they've become more cynical. But I'm not sure that the change, only time will tell, but I'm not sure the change will be a productive one.
Have you an opinion about nuclear power and what we have to do?
Yeah, I've always had an opinion about... my opinion about nuclear power has not changed. I think that it was very foolish to invest so much in a complex technology that has a limited amount of fuel and no solution for its waste storage problems. It's a legacy for future generations. And I just don't believe that that's responsible behavior
mm-hmm.
so that we can have energy now.
Mm-hmm.
And I still feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm surprised that Three Mile Island happened in the sense that I didn't really believe that when we had problems, they were going to be with the operation of the reactors. Because when you look at some of the summaries of the things like the Rasmussen study and so on, it looks like the big problems are going to be with containing wastes and with keeping workers safe in operating the whole fuel cycle
mm-hmm.
and things. Of course, the Karen Silkwood case was in the news toward the end of the thing. But there's an example of, and there are a lot of there have been a lot of expose articles, and I don't know how accurate they are, about occupational exposures being hushed up by people in the fuel industry.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of this kind of thing. So I expected the problems to be
rather than what actually happened, rather than an actual problem at a plant.
Mm-hmm.
You figured they had that fail-safe system.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't think it was absolutely fail-safe, but I didn't. My reading of the situation is that it was a chain of human errors on top of some mechanical failures, but that the chain was quite long and it could have been broken at any point, and it would have been a minor incident instead of a major incident.
Did you hear any jokes about radiation or chemo?
Well, I heard the same things you guys were starting to collect. I went down to the radio station with you. I heard a joke in San Francisco. I was there in late May. So people were making jokes out there. And I made mental note of that because of your project. But somebody said something about, did you know that Hershey bars are the only candy that glow in the dark or something.
This was in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Remember any others? Do you remember what circumstance that was?
Yeah, I was at a Sunday morning, and my brother belonged to this jogging club, and they were going out for their Sunday morning run, and he introduced me to someone. He said I was from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and they said, is that near Three Mile Island? And so I got the, did you hear? What was the context?
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any others?
No, I don't think I mentioned any others.
Is there anything else you would like to say about all this?
No. I think the college's response has been more creative than the community.
Mm-hmm.
But then the college has resources for that sort of thing. And I thought the college handled the situation as well as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I say that because I suppose partly I had a role in it and I agreed with the decisions that were made.
Mm-hmm.
I think, for example, that Bank's statement was very accurate and very well written. I did not write it, but I knew George Allen and Charlie Silver wrote it.
Which one?
There's a statement announcing the closing of the college.
Oh, right.
For the
letter?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And they're understandable, and I think, again, I think if I were a parent in Connecticut hearing CBS News or what have you, I'm not an expert on which of the media were the most least responsible and which were the most, but just I probably would have asked my children to come home.
Mm-hmm.
So everything fits. I mean, it's not, I'm disturbed about the people who, the students I've had to talk to whose parents want them to transfer and think they're totally contaminated and completely poisoned, because I think it's an unreasoned reaction, overreaction. But I've worked with people on medical x-rays, and I get letters and phone calls from people who have one chest x-ray and they're sure, and it's like a neurosis. They're sure they're going to die of cancer, and they want to know all about it. They want me to tell them when they're going to get cancer and what it's going to be like and how should they prepare for their doom and things like that. And no amount of reassurance works.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have other people who are just totally indifferent to the situation. Only a few x-rays are going to hurt you. Just forget about it. So people run a spectrum, and you always get, it's like a Gaussian. I have images of a Gaussian curve. You have a few people out there, some of whom are totally underreact, and some people who totally overreact, and then other people are in between. So we're still dealing with some of those who are very, just sure that the world has come to an end for them. But I, if it wasn't Three Mile Island, something else would make them feel that way. I think it's personality.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? What did I miss?
I don't know. That's a very thorough interview. Yeah.